I want to get back to the series on money and wealth. And before I talk about acquiring and saving and managing money, I want to dispel the idea out there that money or the acquisition of it or the possession of it is evil, because that is not true. But there are people that believe that. They just look at money as a filthy thing or something, and that good people shouldn't be concerned with such things. And I'm going to show you that that is most definitely not true. It is not wrong for Christians to have wealth. Let's look at just some examples of men in the Bible, great men in the Bible, good, godly men who were rich. There's nothing wrong with being rich under certain circumstances. Genesis 13 and verse 2. You probably won't hear these verses preached among some people that preach a social gospel or something like that. They would like you to think that all godly people are poor, that if you're godly, you're going to be like the monks who take the vow of poverty and divest yourself of all your worldly goods and sit around with your legs crossed humming all your life or something. But that is not what the Bible teaches that godly people do. Abraham is our first example. He was a man of great wealth. Genesis 13 and verse 2. Now, on the other hand, you'll also hear people that preach the prosperity gospel use these verses which say, see, every Christian should be wealthy, and if you're not, you don't have faith, and you're not in God's will, because if you were, you'd be rich. So, of course, there's two opposite extremes that are both wrong, as is the case with many things. But here, look at what is said of Abraham. Genesis 13 and verse 2. And Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold. Very rich. So a very wealthy man. And I was just looking at this verse and I was thinking about it and I thought, well, this is interesting. Abraham had liquid assets. Liquid meaning they are very easily got to, very easily used or spent, right? So your house is not a liquid asset, right? Or your business is not a liquid asset or things like that. But your liquid assets are your cash, right? Or your balances in your checking account or savings account. And Abraham has liquid assets here. He's got silver and gold. And silver would be the lower valued one. Silver is the money you use for day-to-day transactions, right? So this is Abraham's checking account. Okay, think about that. Abraham's got a checking account, and gold is much more valuable. It's not something you generally use to buy things from day to day because it's too valuable, but it's where you store your wealth. That's your savings account. So Abraham has a checking account. Abraham has a savings account. And Abraham also has investments. You notice that? It says he has cattle. Cattle are an investment. Cattle are an income-producing asset. They produce milk. They produce other cattle, which produce meat. They produce oxen, which you can use to work and to plow, right? So cattle are an investment. They are an income, wealth-producing asset. So Abraham has money in his checking account, he's got money in his savings account, and he has money in his investment account, his stock market account. You say, well, that's ridiculous. Abraham didn't have stock. Did you read the verse? What are cattle called? Livestock. Abraham has stock. He's got livestock. And in those days, that's your investment account. So Abraham's a wise man. He's got liquid assets. He's got retirement assets that are income-producing assets. Abraham is not just a consumer. Abraham owns things that are going to make him more wealthy, not make him less wealthy. Right? He's not just blowing his money. See, you didn't see all that in that little verse, did you? Isn't that interesting? Let's go to David. Let's look at David. David was also a rich man. 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 28. 1 Chronicles 29:28. So follow Abraham's example. You should have money for your day-to-day stuff. You should be laying money away for savings, for emergency fund, for the future, and you should have investments, putting your money to work, having it make money for you. We should follow Abraham's example. But I'll have a lot more to say about that in this series. All right, 1 Chronicles 29 and verse 28. This is speaking of David, and he died in a good old age, which I know this is just mean, but you know what his good old age was when it said he was very old? 70. That was his good old age when the Bible said he was very old and well stricken in years. He died in a good old age, full of days, riches, and honor, and Solomon his son reigned in his stead. So David died rich. Nothing wrong with being rich. And notice, he died rich. He didn't die broke, right? The goal is to die rich, or at least to die with some money, right? Not to die broke. He didn't spend all of his money before he died. He left an inheritance, right? I've heard stupid people say this. I mean, I've literally had a man tell me this, that his goal was to spend his last penny on the very last day that he died, and he hoped that the day that he spent his last penny, he and his wife would get killed in a fiery car crash. And he was joking and kind of being funny, but he wasn't really kidding. When he wanted to spend, he wanted to live and spend his last penny when he died. That is the dumbest thing ever, for many reasons. Number one, you don't know when you're going to die. You say, oh, you know, the average age is 77. I'm going to blow all my money by age 77, so, you know, I get to enjoy it all. All right, dummy, what happens if you live to 97? Then what? Stupid. Don't try to spend all your money. That's the dumbest thing you can do. Try to make it last to the end of your life, and then you might actually have something to pass on to the next generation. All right, I'm going to say more about that too. But anyway, later. Solomon, let's get to another wealthy person in the Bible. 1 Kings 10 and verse 23. 1 Kings 10, 23. 1 Kings 10, 23. So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom. Okay, so nothing wrong with having wealth is the point. And remember, though, you know why Solomon ended up with so much money, with so much riches? It's because it was not his life's goal. It was not his life's goal to have riches. When the Lord came to him and said, essentially, ask me whatever you want and I'll give it to you. You know what he asked for? Wisdom. He didn't ask for riches. He didn't ask for long life. And he didn't ask to have his enemies under his feet. And you know what the Lord said? Because you've asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you riches. I'm going to give you long life. I'm going to put your enemies under your feet. So when your heart is right, riches will just be a byproduct. It'll be a byproduct. But if you're going after riches, if you're going after money, you're not going to end up with much. And the Bible is going to tell us this. We're going to look at some verses later on today, which will show us this. Now, these are Old Testament examples. But here's a New Testament example. It's not wrong for Christians to have wealth. It's actually a good thing. Rich believers are exhorted not to give away all their wealth or take some vow of poverty or something, but rather to not trust in it and be willing to give it to those who are in need. 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19. Now, I know somebody might be thinking, but Jesus told the rich young ruler to sell all that he had, give it to the poor, and come and follow me. That's true. But you know, that was an isolated incident. This man came to Jesus, wanted to know, what do I do to get eternal life? Jesus says, keep all the commandments. He says, oh, I've done all that stuff. Jesus says, oh, really? Okay, here's another one. Sell all that you have. Follow me. You know, give it to the poor and follow me. Jesus found the idol in his heart and required that of him. But this was not a universal commandment that all believers sell everything they have and give to the poor. Because if we all did that, guess what? We can't keep the rest or a lot of the other commandments in the Bible, like if any provide not for his own, especially they of his own house, he's worse than an infidel and hath denied the faith, right? So if every one of us gave away everything that we own, and you don't have a clothes on your back or a roof over your head, you don't have anything, how are you going to provide for your family? How are you going to provide for yourself, right? So obviously Jesus isn't going to require of us something that would make us not be able to keep the other commandments in the Bible and require of us to be a bunch of homeless bums, right? He's not going to do that. He did that for a specific person, for a specific reason, right? Look at what Paul says here. And Paul got his gospel from Jesus Christ, so he's not contradicting him. 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19. Charge them that are rich in this world that they give it all away. Is that what he said? They give it all away. Give it all to the United Way. Is that what he said? That they be not high-minded. They don't want to be proud of their wealth. Nor trust in uncertain riches. But in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. There's so much preaching in that verse. We'll get to some of that later too. Later in the series. That they do good. That they be rich in good works. Ready to distribute. Willing to communicate. Communicates to give a part or a share. To distribute. So that's a good version of wealth distribution. When rich people distribute their own wealth, that's good. Right? That's what they're supposed to do. When wicked, evil bureaucrats try to distribute the rich man's wealth for him, that's called theft, and that's evil. Right? So government distribution of wealth is evil because they just steal from one person and give to another person. But biblical distribution of wealth is you distribute your own wealth. You help out people that are in need. And that's why it's incumbent on all of us to lay up, to have money laid up for godly purposes, and just to lay up wealth in general, because when you're wealthy, you can help people, you can do things. When you're poor, you can't do much of anything. See, Let me finish. I didn't finish the passage here. Verse 19. Laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. See, when rich people do that, when they're rich in good works, when they're ready to distribute, he didn't say distribute immediately. He didn't say give it all away. He said be ready to distribute. Right? When they're ready to do so, when they're willing to communicate, ready and willing, they want to help out people who are in genuine need when they find them, like the Good Samaritan. Right? When they are like that, they are laying up for themselves in store a good foundation against the time to come. They're basically doing what Jesus said when he said, lay not treasure up on earth, but lay up treasure in heaven. These people have treasure in earth and treasure in heaven. You see, they're doing well with their treasure on earth, and by doing well with their treasure on earth and being willing and ready to help other people, they're laying up treasure in heaven also. They've got treasure both places. Isn't that neat? See, rich Christians are a blessing to their families, to their churches, to their friends, to their neighbors, and to their community, if they're godly and doing it right. Of course, they could also be a bunch of misers and greedy jerks too. Right? But if rich Christians are doing what Paul told Timothy to do here, they're a blessing. And the thing is, I've said this before, I said it maybe, it seems like a few weeks ago, months ago, that oftentimes you can't help other people if you don't have money. You've got to have money to help other people. Right? You can help other people with your time, that's true, and you can pray for other people, of course, that's very important. But in a lot of cases, you may want to help, but you can't. If you don't have money, you can't help. I think it was it Margaret Thatcher? I have a quote from her later on in the study. I think it was Margaret Thatcher, the Prime Minister of England back in the 80s. And she said that the only reason why the Good Samaritan was ever mentioned in the Bible is because he had money. If the Good Samaritan would not have had money, he wouldn't have been able to help that guy that was beaten up and left half dead. Because he took care of him, he gave him medical care, he took him to an inn, and he paid the innkeeper to keep this man for several days and take care of him. And when he came back, he would pay the remainder of the balance, whatever he had in it. What's a hotel cost today? $150? A few days? $450 probably? Medical care? That guy's probably walking around with at least $1,000 in his pocket, ready to take care of somebody else when the person needed it. But if that Good Samaritan would have just been a bum that didn't work and never saved any money, he could have wanted to help that guy all he wanted to, and what could he have done for him? Not a whole lot. Maybe he could have begged the innkeeper to show some charity, right? But he wouldn't have been able to do anything. All right, so it requires money to help people. And I've said this before too. How many hospitals, schools, libraries, parks, and charitable organizations do you know that poor people have founded and funded? Zero. Poor people don't build hospitals. Poor people don't build libraries. Poor people don't build charitable organizations. They don't build schools, right? They don't do any of that. There's nothing wrong with poor people. That's fine if you're poor because, God's chosen that for you. But what I'm saying is, rich people build these things. Rich people that are good, decent people, they don't just take all their money and do like, what was it in the cartoon thing? I forget, Scrooge or whoever it was. I forget who it was, where he just went there and like bathed in his money. You know, he just, I remember, I don't know if you saw it, but it was a cartoon thing. And he would get in there and he'd like, you know, like just throw his money up, like raining down on him, like he was just having fun with it. That's not what rich people do. You know, rich people build, you know, things that benefit society and help other people if they're doing it right. So I'm just trying to get it through your mind. There's nothing wrong with being rich if you're rich and godly at the same time. But we all have to be careful about this. Both rich and poor have to be careful not to trust in riches, because rich people have a tendency to trust in their riches to protect them. Let's look at Proverbs 18 and verse 11. See, anything can be abused. Anything can be misused. Right? Wealth is a good thing if it's done right, but it can be a terrible thing if it's done wrong. It can ruin your soul. It can be an idol in your heart. Proverbs 18 and verse 11. The rich man's wealth is his strong city, and as an high wall in his own conceit, in his own thoughts, in his own mind, his riches are like a high wall that surrounds his city. They're his protection. He puts his trust in his riches. He thinks that nothing's going to happen to him because of this money that he has, that he's protected. Nobody's ever going to harm him, right? He's putting his trust and his confidence in money instead of God. And that's a big problem. You never want to do that, because you know what happens when you trust in your riches? Because remember, God's a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. God can see what's in your heart. Whether other people can or not, God can. And if he sees somebody that's trusting in his riches, you know what he's going to do? He's going to take it. God doesn't have any rivals. God's not going to let anybody, anything, or anybody take his place in your life. He finds you trusting in riches, he'll take it. I'll talk about that in a minute. The Bible talks about that. Now, the poor also have a tendency to trust in riches. Their trust is a little different, though. They trust that it would save them from all their problems. If they just had it, they wouldn't have any problems. Everything would be great if they just had some more money. Right? So they trust in it, too. They just don't have any. Rich people trust in what they have. Poor people trust in what they wish they had and think if they just had it, their life would be wonderful. And then they'd find out that money doesn't improve the quality of your life very much anyway. I'll talk about that later yet today also. But fools think that it will until they get some, and then they realize that, oh, my life is still screwed up. I just have more money and more problems now, and my life is just no better than it was before. The Bible's replete with warnings not to trust in riches. Psalm 62 and verse 10 tells us that if riches increase, we are not to set our hearts upon them. Psalm 62 and verse 10. Trust not in oppression, and become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. See, the problem is not the riches increasing, unless you did it by oppression and robbery, which is kind of what the context here. But assuming that you didn't do it through oppression and robbery, right? If you did it by providing goods and services that people want and need, and you've improved their lives, and they trade you their money that they think is less valuable than the goods and services that you provided them, which is how a free market works, and your riches increase that way, there's nothing wrong with that. But don't set your heart upon them. That's the problem. Two problems with that. The first problem is that it can become an idol in your heart. The second problem is you're going to be very disappointed, because someday those riches are going to vanish. Because that's what happened to riches. They vanish. And I got some verses for you here in a minute. So you don't want to set your heart upon them. Be thankful for them. Be grateful for them. Enjoy them while you have, or I always say, enjoy a little bit of them while you have them, and lay up the rest of them for the future. But don't ever set your heart upon them. Job taught us that to make gold one's hope and to rejoice in wealth is a sin and a denial of God. Job 31, verses 24 through 25 and 28. Job 31, 24 through 25 and 28. Job says, if I had made gold my hope, see, our hope's only supposed to be in the Lord. Hope thou in God, the Bible tells us. If I had made gold my hope, or if said to fine gold, thou art my confidence. Confidence is the same as faith, right? So he said, you're my confidence. I'm putting my faith in gold. You do that, you're in trouble. If I rejoiced because my wealth was great and because mine hand had gotten much. I just read for the, just to get the context here in verse 28, when we get down to verse 28. If I beheld the sun when it shined and the moon walking in its brightness. He's talking about idolatry here, worshiping the sun and the moon. And my heart hath been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand. Another pagan occultic thing. This also were an iniquity to be punished by the judge, for I should have denied the God that is above. All these things are actually related. Making gold your hope, making gold your confidence, rejoicing in your wealth, and sun worship, moon worship, occultism, you know, evil idolatry. All those things are idolatry. Covetousness is idolatry. Worshipping your wealth is idolatry. Having confidence in your wealth instead of God is idolatry. And Job said, if I have done this, it's an iniquity to be punished by the judge, and I have denied the God that is above. So you never want to trust in it. You never want to have confidence in it. You never want to rejoice in it. If we're going to rejoice or glory in anything, we should glory that we know and understand God, not in our riches. Jeremiah 9, 23 through 24. I'm trying to give you a balanced view of wealth in this series. I don't want you to walk away and think that money is the most important thing in the world. I don't want you to think that it should be the thing that we should desire above all else. But I also don't want you to think it's evil. And I don't want you to be lazy and irresponsible and not lay up money for the future. I want you to have a balanced view of wealth. Jeremiah 9, 23 through 24. Thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might. Let not the rich man glory in his riches. Isn't that three things that men glory in the most? Wisdom, their education, right? Don't men glory in that? And they love to put their letters on the end of their name and be called by doctor and all this, doctor so-and-so, when they're not really a doctor. You know how you can tell if somebody's really a doctor, right? If you're on an airplane and somebody has a heart attack and somebody screams out, is there a doctor on board? If you say yes, you're actually a doctor. If you're a doctor of philosophy or a doctor of education or whatever, you don't say yes. You keep your hand down, right? You're not really a doctor. I got that line from somebody else. I thought that was funny. But anyway, you know, people glory in that. They glory in their education. They glory in their might, right, in their strength, especially young men. Young men, the glory of young men is their strength, we're told. They glory in their muscles and so on. And they glory in their money, right? Isn't that, that's pretty much the three things that, men really glory in. But here's what the Lord says. But let him that glorieth glory in this. Don't glory in those things. Here's what you glory in. That he understandeth and knoweth me. That I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. See, glory in that you know God. You know, having wisdom is good. I mean, God, the Bible says, get wisdom. So it's not wrong to have wisdom. It's wrong to glory in it. It's not wrong to have it. To be strong, there's nothing wrong with that. God, how many times in the Bible does God say, be strong? Right? Now, he's speaking of inner strength. But right, there's nothing wrong with being strong, right? That's fine. You don't want to glory in it. There's nothing wrong with having money, but you don't want to glory in it. Now, remember I said that one of the reasons why you don't want to put hope in riches is because they don't last forever. You know, the Bible calls them uncertain riches. Let me just give you a few verses here, though. Proverbs 27 and verse 24. We just see here that the Bible teaches us that riches, wealth, does not last forever. Now, of course, you know, with some people, it does last their entire life. Some people are able to hold on to it. I mean, the Proverbs says this, a strong men retain riches. Gracious women retain honor, right? So some people can hold on to it. But even the wisest, most prudent, most frugal person can lose it, right? Sometimes it just happens. Life happens and they go, right? Sometimes due to no fault of your own whatsoever. Proverbs 27 and verse 24 says, riches are not forever, and doth the crown endure to every generation. They're not forever. And actually, let's back up to verse 23. I'll have more to say about this verse later on also, but just to get the context here, he says, be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks and look well to thy herds. Remember what I said about Abraham, his flocks? Those were his investments, right? Those were his income-producing assets. And he says here, be diligent to know the state of thy flocks. So in other words, look at your portfolio once in a while. Look at your investments. See where you invested. See what's going on there. See if you should leave your investments where they are or move them to something else. Right? You got to manage this stuff. That's what the Bible, that's what it's telling you to do here. Why? For riches are not forever. If you just set it and forget it, you may go back someday and it's all gone. All right? With your investments. You got to pay attention. You got to take an inventory of things once in a while. Proverbs 23 and verse 3. But like I said, I'll have more to say about that later. Proverbs 23 and verse 5, pardon me. 23:5. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Especially when dumb people have them. When dumb people have them, they fly away really fast. When wise people have them, sometimes they still fly away. But dumb people, they can't hold on to them for 2 seconds. As the old Irish proverb says, a fool and his money are soon parted. They make themselves wings and fly away. A friend of mine found this out. She was going grocery shopping. She stopped at the bank or the ATM ahead of time, got a big fat stack of $100 bills to go grocery shopping, put them in her wallet, and didn't zip up the wallet or something, and somehow got out of the car, and the wallet fell out, and it was windy, and there were just $100 bills blowing all over the parking lot, and she's running around, like, grabbing the $100 bills. She managed to find them all. But, you know, people are, like, seeing this happening and, like, helping her trying to get stuff. And I thought, that's a great illustration. Thanks for telling me about that. Because, I mean, talk about riches making themselves wings and flying away as an eagle toward heaven. Like, sometimes they literally do. And then for a more realistic explanation of this, for anybody that's ever invested in volatile sectors of the stock market, riches can make themselves wings and fly away like an eagle toward heaven very quickly. It's nothing to lose thousands of dollars in a day when you're invested in those kind of sectors. And it's nothing to make thousands of dollars in a day when you're invested in those kind of things. And if you're really rich, you could lose millions of dollars in a day, even billions of dollars. You know, NVIDIA, that's the company that makes the AI chips, and it's like one of the most valuable companies in the world now, probably way overbought. But anyway, the Chinese came out and said they came out with a new AI chip which can do what the ChatGPT system did with like 5% of the money and 5% of the energy and 5% of the everything. And NVIDIA's stock fell I think it was like 17% or something, which was the equivalent of hundreds of billions of dollars in like 1 second. Riches make themselves wings and fly away as an eagle toward heaven. You just never know. Psalm 49, verses 10 through 12. That's why you don't put confidence in your riches. You imagine if you're some fat cat and you had like a big chunk of your portfolio invested in NVIDIA, you just lost like huge amounts of money overnight. And maybe it come back, who knows. But anyway, the point is just don't trust in it. And another rule of thumb is don't ever invest any money you can't afford to lose. Any money that you invest, only invest money you can afford to lose. If it's all gone, it's no big deal. I mean, you're disappointed, but you're not homeless and destitute. Psalm 49, 10 through 12. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought, listen to this, their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever. You know, maybe their physical house will continue forever, or their house, like the house of Rothschild or the house of Rockefeller, right? Their family name and legacy, it's going to last forever. They're always going to be a rich family. Their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Right? They think that their wealth is perpetual and nothing is ever going to happen to it. Nevertheless, man being in honor abideth not. He is like the beasts that perish. At a minimum, he's going to die and he's not going to take any of it with him. So his house isn't going to last forever, even if it lasts for his entire life. Someday he's going to die. And if he's a wicked man, like this verse is talking about here, you know what? All that wealth isn't going to do you any good when you're burning in hell. It doesn't last forever, even if you manage to make it last to the end of your life here. And the other problem with trusting in riches is that it'll cause you to fall. Proverbs 11 and verse 28. Not only might you be disappointed, but it'll also cause a downfall, a moral downfall, and it could be a financial downfall as well. Proverbs 11 and verse 28. He that trusteth in his riches shall fall. Now again, notice, it doesn't say he that has riches shall fall. It says he that trusteth in his riches. You always want to take note of things like that. But the righteous shall flourish as a branch. See, the problem is trusting. You trust in your riches, you'll fall. Now compare that with the, Proverbs 16, 18, I think it is, maybe, or 18, 16, I think it's 16, 18, yeah. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, right? He that trusteth in his riches shall fall. Why is he falling? Because he trusts in his riches because he's proud, right? He's proud of his riches. He's got a really high opinion of himself because he's wealthy. And that will cause one to fall. Like I said earlier, God will have no rivals. Now, this could be really rich people. I mean, billionaires could trust in their riches, or it could be just normal people. They could trust in it. Or it could go the other way around. You could have a Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, right? You name the billionaire out there. And theoretically, those men could have billions and billions of dollars and not trust in it. And just think, oh, you know, it's nice while I have it, and if it's gone, no big deal, right? Theoretically, hypothetically, they could not trust in it, and they'd be perfectly fine. And then you could just have old Joe Blow, just average Joe, and he's got $15,000 in his emergency fund, you know, his 3 to 6 months of living expenses. He's got his little 15 grand there, and he could be trusting in that with everything that he has, thinking, this is my strong tower. I'm not worried about anything because I know I've got this money laid up, and if something happens, I'm going to be okay. And he's trusting in that little nest egg thing that he has there, right? He could be the one that's ready to fall. And the billionaire who's not trusting in his wealth would be just fine. Just as an example. So it can go either way. It doesn't matter. You could trust in wealth if you're really rich or if you don't have much. Any of us, no matter what our station is, could be guilty of trusting in whatever little that we have. So the point is, don't trust in it. Have it. Be prudent. You should have it. You should have your emergency fund, but don't trust in it. You trust in God. And then also, this is an important one and a very dangerous thing, is that trusting in riches will obstruct one's way into the kingdom of God, which is the local church. Mark 10, 23 through 25. This is the account of the rich young ruler. It's found in Luke and Matthew's gospel as well. Mark chapter 10, 23 through 25. And Jesus looked round about and saith unto his disciples. This is after, I mentioned this earlier, when the man came to him and he told him to sell all that he had and give to the poor and he'd have treasure in heaven. Come follow me. And the man was sad at that saying, and he went away grieved for great possessions. And then right after that, this is what Jesus said. And Jesus looked round about, and saith unto his disciples, How hardly shall they that have riches enter into the kingdom of God? And the disciples were astonished at his words. But Jesus answereth again, and saith unto them, Children, how hard is it for them that, see it, trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God? The NIV actually deletes that part, for them that trust in riches. But that's the key to the whole passage. He says, how hard is it for they that have riches to enter the kingdom? And then the disciples are blown away. And then he specifies, how hard is it for them that trust in riches? See, it's hard for both. It's hard for people that have riches to get into the kingdom. It's really hard for people that trust in it, because they have a heart problem, big time. But it's also hard for people that have it, because people that have it sometimes think they're a little better than other people. They might not want to rub shoulders with the average normal people of the earth. They certainly don't want some stupid preacher up there yelling at them every Sunday, telling them what to do. I mean, after all, I'm a rich guy. I know a heck of a lot more than you do, right? So they don't like that. All kinds of things. You know, they don't probably don't have a great dependency on God, because they've got their money and they can depend on that and trust in that. It's just it's hard for rich people to get into the kingdom. That's why, you know, most of the churches just have average folks in them. You know, not too many rich people generally end up in true churches. And then Jesus goes on to say, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. So that's how hard it is. That's how rare it is for a camel to go through the eye of a needle, which, you know, if you know how big the eye of a needle is and you know how big a camel is, right? I mean, he's giving you a word picture there, an illustration to show it's pretty much impossible, right, for a rich man, especially a rich man who trusts in his riches, to enter into the kingdom. And furthermore, it'd be fine to have rich people in church, but we don't want rich people that trust in their riches in church anyway, right? We don't want that kind of people that are proud and full of themselves and trusting in money instead of God. We don't want that here. And then one more warning about trusting in riches is that, you know, some people out there think that they're going to prepare for doomsday and load up on gold and silver, and this is going to protect them from no matter come what may, right? This is going to be their hedge and protection. And it's a good idea to have some gold and silver. I'm not saying it's not. But it's not going to protect you from the wrath of God to come. Ezekiel 7 and verse 19. I mean, whether that's the second coming of Christ, it definitely isn't going to protect you in that day. Or whether that's just a severe, harsh judgment. Imagine if you were a Jew in Jerusalem when the Babylonians destroyed it, or when the Romans destroyed it, and they surround the city, and there's a famine in Jerusalem, and there is not a scrap of food to be found anywhere. You could have yourself a literal ton of gold, and what are you going to do with it? There's no food to buy. Right, so if things get that bad, it's not going to help you. People say, you know, what good is gold? You can't eat it. Yeah, and you can't eat paper money either. Right. The point is not, oh, you can't eat it. What good is gold? The point is you can't eat any money. Right. So, you know, that's a stupid argument. But anyway, it'd be easier to eat paper money than gold. But the nutritional value is about the same. Right. So. Ezekiel 7 and verse 19. Although some of the Jews did try to eat their gold when the Romans surrounded them, they wanted to try to get out with their wealth, and they swallowed their gold coins, until the Romans somehow got rumor that they were doing that, and then when they would catch them, they would cut open their stomachs and get the gold out. So, yeah, it's not going to save you in the wrath to come. Ezekiel 7 and verse 19. They shall cast their silver in the streets, and their gold shall be removed. Their silver and their gold shall not be able to deliver them in the day of the wrath of the Lord. They shall not satisfy their souls nor fill their bowels, because it is the stumbling block of their iniquity. No, it's not going to help them in that day. Zephaniah 1 and verse 18. Now Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them in the day of the Lord's wrath, but the whole land shall be devoured by the fire of his jealousy, and he shall make even a speedy riddance of all them that dwell in the land. So you don't want to trust in it, that's for sure. Now we looked at how it's not wrong for Christians to have wealth. But now let's look at what is wrong. It is wrong for the acquisition of riches to be your life's goal. Okay? That is wrong. It's not wrong to acquire riches and wealth, but it's wrong for that to be your goal. Your driving desire is to get riches. That is wrong. And we'll look at that. Proverbs 23 and verse 4 tells us to labor not to be rich. Proverbs 23 and verse 4. And I want to give a nuanced view of this, because if you took this verse and just said, labor not to be rich, it says, labor not to be rich, cease from thine own wisdom. And you took that verse and you think that's the only verse in the Bible, and you say, well, I'm not supposed to work to save money. That's how you get rich, right? You work and save money. You underconsume. That's how you get rich. Right? That's how the majority of millionaires became millionaires. It wasn't by inheritance. It was that they worked hard, underconsumed. They were frugal. That's how you get rich. Right? Somebody look at that and say, well, I shouldn't work and save money. You are misunderstanding Scripture if you think that. Labor not to be rich. The reason why you're laboring should not be because I want to be rich. I want to have tons of money. You shouldn't labor for that reason. Because there's a lot of millionaires out there. I've been reading this book, you know, on The Millionaire Next Door. And there's a lot of millionaires. In fact, most millionaires don't spend very much of their money. That's why they're millionaires. If they spent a lot of their money, they wouldn't be millionaires. They really should probably rename the book, you know, and redo it a little bit, The Multimillionaire Next Door, because a millionaire these days is really not that big of a deal. I mean, especially if you count home equity. If you count home equity, to be a millionaire is not really that. I mean, it's okay, but if somebody gave you $1 million, you think you'd be rich? Come on. Buying just a decent house with a little bit of property and a few nice cars, and your $1 million is gone. Gone. I mean, $1 million, like I said, is, you're not rich. But if you're wise and frugal, you could live off it for the rest of your life and invest it and all that. But you're not rich if you have $1 million, not by any stretch. But millionaires, they do tend to keep working. Most of them are small business owners, statistically. They do tend to keep working, and they have a drive. But money to them is more of like a barometer. It's more of a gauge. It's more of a scorecard. It's showing them that they're doing well. They're doing the right things in business, because that's what profit is. Profit shows you that you're doing well. You are producing goods and services that others want. You're doing so efficiently, right? You're doing so cheaply, and therefore you're able to make a profit. So for a lot of millionaires, the reason that they like making more money is because that's showing them that they are doing good in business. They are doing well. They are making things that people want efficiently. So it's their, you know, like I said, it's their gauge. They're not necessarily just working just to get more and more and more, because they don't spend it. For them, it's not about getting more so they can get more stuff, because millionaires don't buy a bunch of stuff. Millionaires want to be financially independent. They don't want to be dependent on anybody else. They want to be totally self-sufficient. That's the average millionaire. Anyway, so when he says labor not to be rich, you don't labor for the purpose of being rich. But if you're somebody who continues to work to build wealth, because that's your gauge to show that I'm doing good business here, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Jesus taught us that a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses. Let's look at Luke 12 and verse 15. Luke 12, 15. And he said unto them, take heed and beware of covetousness, For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. See, he's talking about covetousness. People that just want more and more and more. They want stuff. They want abundance. They want things, right? And he says, a man's life doesn't consist in that. And if your life does, your life is wrong. I mean, your whole mindset is wrong. Your heart's wrong, right? Your life doesn't consist in getting a bunch of stuff. That's not what it should consist of. Now, people might take verses like this, you know, and verses like the one we just looked at, and where Jesus said, lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, lay it not up for yourselves treasures on earth. And they might look at this and say, Jesus is discouraging us from becoming wealthy. He's discouraging us from working, saving, being frugal, laying up for yourself so that you have, you know, much laid up. But he's not discouraging that. He's telling you that your life doesn't consist in that, of getting more and more stuff. That's not what's important in life. As a matter of fact, Jesus taught, well, it's right after this passage, he taught the parable of the guy that his farm brought forth plentifully, and he says, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger barns, you know, and then I'll eat, drink, and be merry, take my ease. Right? The problem was, though, that he wasn't rich toward God. That's what the Lord said there. Thou fool, this night shall thy soul be required of thee. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. See, his problem was he wanted it all for himself. He was covetous and he wasn't rich toward God. So when you look at it in context here, Jesus is not saying it's wrong to have accumulated wealth. And I don't want you to get the wrong impression, like that I'm preaching this sermon that I think money is just the most important thing and that, you know, we all ought to work to be wealthy and because, you know, that's what Christians should be. It's not about getting rich. My goal is not to be rich, okay? But my goal is to have enough wealth to provide for my wife and myself until we die. And if you've ever used a calculator, you know that that takes a lot of money. That takes a lot of money. See, in my mind, Social Security doesn't exist. I don't think it will exist when I get there. And I don't even consider that in any financial planning whatsoever. It does not exist. Inheritance doesn't exist. Nothing exists except what I save up, what I earn myself. That is the only thing in my mind that exists. And for me to have enough money and investments and wealth laid up to take care of myself and my wife until we die takes a lot of money. Because I could die at 70, and so could my wife. No big deal, right? I could also die at 95, like my grandmother Wagner, almost 95 years old. My grandmother Beery, 91 years old, still living. I could be like my grandfather. My grandfather Wagner died at 86, and then my grandma lived for another 19 years until almost 95. Even worse, I could be like my grandfather Beery, who died at 61, and his widow lived for 30 years afterwards. I don't know if I'll ever get there, but my goal is to have enough laid up so that myself and my wife can live off of what we have saved for our entire lives, even if I lived to 95. Now, without any other assistance, without socialist insecurity, like I like to call it, or anything else, that requires a lot of money. You got to have a lot of money. You have to have invested. You got to be able to live off of those investments. That is biblical, because the Bible says in 1 Timothy 5 that if any man provide not for his own, and especially for they of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So in order to provide for my wife and myself, that means I have to lay up a lot of money. And there is not a thing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, it is my duty before God as a Christian to do that. You don't want to love riches, but you do want to lay them up to provide for yourself and for your family. So yeah, do I think it's important to save and to become wealthy? Yes, I do, because you may need it. You very well may need it, especially when there's no social safety net left and all you have is what you have saved. But getting back to what Jesus is teaching us here about your life not consisting of the abundance of things which you possess, if your life is just about buying stuff and just getting stuff and you're a hyper consumer like most Americans are and you just want more and more and you want all the toys and all the fun stuff, your life shouldn't consist of that, number one. And number two, what good is having a bunch of stuff that you don't need anyway? That's what Solomon taught us in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 5, 11 through 12. Ecclesiastes 5, 11 through 12. When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, saving the beholding of them with their eyes? And that's what a lot of people end up doing. They basically just keep buying and acquiring more and more and more stuff. And the only good it is to look at it. I know people like this. Buy more and more and more stuff to look at it. And then it only lasts for a little while because they can't see it because they piled more crap on top of the old crap and they can't even see the other crap. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. You don't, I've said it many times before, but you don't own stuff. Stuff owns you. The more stuff you own, the more it owns you. And it gets hard to keep up with it all. And it gets expensive to keep up with it all. The Bible tells us in Proverbs 28 and verse 20 that they that haste to be rich shall not be innocent in doing so, and they will end up poor in the long run. Proverbs 28 and verse 20. It's not wrong to have wealth, but it is wrong for the acquisition of riches to be your life's goal. Proverbs 28 and verse 20. A faithful man shall abound with blessings, but he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. It doesn't say that he is rich. He that is rich shall not be innocent. But again, to always look at the words. Always look at the words. Look at what it's saying there. He that hasteth, he that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent. He that wants to get rich quick, right? It's his desire, and he wants to get rich no matter what, and he's going to do whatever it takes to get rich as quickly as possible. That might mean cheating. It might mean stealing. It might mean defrauding your customers or clients. It may mean embezzling money out of the business. Who knows what it might mean? But it'll mean cutting corners somewhere or the other. And you won't be innocent if your life's goal is to get rich and to get rich quick. You'll end up poor in the long run. Verse 22. He that hasteth to be rich hath an evil eye and considereth not that poverty shall come upon him. You know, Bernie Madoff hasted to get rich, and he did. I think he was a multi-billionaire. He was the one that ran that great big Ponzi scheme here 20-some years ago. But eventually, he went to the poorhouse. He's in prison now. I think he still is. I'm sure he is. He made haste to be rich. He had an evil eye, ripped a lot of people off, but it didn't last. And you have to know that, right? Who in their right mind thinks that you're going to be able to long-term rip people off and pay off current investors with, or pay off past investors with current investors, and that you're going to be able to keep this whole thing going forever? Eventually, you're going to run out of suckers. And it's not going to work, but I guess, you know, people that are doing stuff like that aren't thinking rationally. Paul taught us here in 1 Timothy 6, he talks a lot about money in 1 Timothy 6. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but in 1 Timothy 6, he says that they that will be rich, they that desire to be rich, will fall into a snare. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 9. It says, but they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. They that will be rich. He's not talking about that they that want to lay up in store so that they can take care of their family for the remainder of their lives, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about people that want to be rich and do whatever they need to be rich. They're going to run into many foolish and hurtful lusts, temptations and snares, destruction and perdition, because they will cut corners. He goes on to say, the love of money is the root of all evil. Verse 10, for the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Said it before. Probably every preacher under the sun has said it before. I'm sure you've heard this before. It's not money that's the root of all evil. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. Money is an amoral thing. A piece of gold, a piece of silver, a piece of paper is not good or evil. There's nothing good or evil about a piece of paper or a piece of metal. It's the love of money that's the root of all evil. Think about Gehazi. Remember Gehazi? He was the Elisha's servant. Remember the prophet Elisha? There's a man named Naaman. He was a Syrian. He was a captain of the host of the Syrians, I think. He had leprosy. He went to Elisha to be healed. And Elisha has him dipped 7 times in Jordan. He's healed of his leprosy. He wants to pay Elisha. And Elisha says, I don't want it. He's got all these nice changes of clothes and various things, gifts that he brought. Elisha didn't take any of it. And Naaman, he sends Naaman back to Syria. Naaman starts going off in his chariot entourage there back to Syria, and Gehazi thinks, you know what, Elisha may not want some of those garments and he may not want some of that money, but I do. And he chased him down and said, hey, my master changed his mind, we'd like to have some of that stuff. And he got some of it. And then Elisha said that you're gonna, the leprosy of Naaman is gonna be on you. And that man was a leper till the day he died. See, he would be rich. It was his desire. He had that desire for greed and filthy lucre. Had that love of money. And he ended up piercing himself through with many sorrows. A man of God must especially flee these things. Verse 11. But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. So the man of God, the preacher, must flee the love of money. And apparently, it must be a temptation for some men that get in the ministry to do so for the love of money. Because Paul says that we're not to be greedy of filthy lucre in 1 Timothy and in Titus. And Peter, likewise, says not for filthy lucre's sake, which I'll get to those verses later. And Paul says flee these things. So it's something that preachers have to be careful about. 1 Timothy, just to give you an example of what I was talking about, 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, the qualifications for the ministry are not given to wine, no striker, not greedy of filthy lucre. And I'll define what that is here in a minute. Not greedy of filthy lucre. Jesus taught us in Matthew 6:24 that you cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve two masters. You'll love the one and despise the other, so on. Mammon's another name for money. You can't serve money. You can have money. You can't serve money. You can't love money. You can't trust in money. Right? That's where the problem is. Having it is no problem at all. Trusting in it, serving it, and loving it. That's where the problem is. And you just have to, you got to search your heart. You got to check your heart on those things. Jesus taught that your heart will be where your treasure is. Matthew 6:20-21. You can tell where a man's heart is. Just look at what he loves, what he devotes all of his time and energy and money to, and you'll find out where his heart is. Matthew 6:20-21. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. If you're, the most important thing to you is treasure on this earth, that's what's going on in your heart. If you simply want to lay up enough wealth to take care of yourself and your own, that's fine. Jesus said likewise in Matthew, in Luke 12, 33 through 34, but it's basically a parallel passage, so I won't read that one. And then Lot. You remember Lot, he was Abraham's nephew. He chose wealth over righteousness, and he ended up with neither. Genesis 13, 10 through 13. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves, the one from the other. Abraham dwelled in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. See, Lot didn't really care. He was willing to live among sinners as long as it meant being able to have a good living. That was the most important thing to Lot. And guess what he ended up with? Nothing. His whole city and house and everything got destroyed with fire and brimstone. Now there's this topic of filthy lucre, which I mentioned earlier. The Bible condemns using the ministry for financial gain. And like I said, there are a lot of warnings about this, because, you know, there are, if you haven't noticed, there are some shysters and charlatans out there that try to use the ministry and use religion to make money, especially the ones on TV. Eli's sons were an example of this. These men were using the ministry for financial gain. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3. I don't know if I gave you the verse yet or not. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 3. And his sons walked not in his ways. This is speaking of Samuel, not Eli. Eli had bad kids too, but Samuel, both of them did. And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre, that is money, and took bribes and perverted judgment. Because remember, the priests were also the ones that were the judges. They would, you know, people would come to them for judgments and things. And so they were taking bribes and, you know, not judging rightly to make money. You know, like I said, Paul says, 1 Timothy 3:3, Titus 1:7, 11, and 1 Peter 5:2, all of them say that the minister is not to be in it for filthy lucre's sake. Lucre is gain, profit, pecuniary advantage, now only with unfavorable implication. Gain viewed as a low motive for action. And then it gives the phrase there, filthy lucre. Pecuniary is consisting of money, extracted in money. And filthy is full of filth, besmeared or defiled with filth, dirty, foul, nasty, unclean, morally foul or polluted, obscene. So filthy lucre is gain that is gotten in an ill-mannered way, right? It is gain that is loved, trusted in, got fraudulently, anything like that. That is filthy lucre. Now, again, though, this does not mean that money or the acquisition of it is evil, right? Paul is not saying that a pastor should just disavow all money and not be paid for his services or anything like that. He's saying you shouldn't go into the ministry to get rich or to make money or to try to fleece the sheep or something like that. But he's not saying that money or the acquisition of it's evil, because a pastor is supposed to be financially compensated for his labor. 1 Corinthians 9, 6 through 14 is a lengthy passage there. We've read it many times before. I'm not going to read it all. But it talks about how a minister would be paid for his wages or for his labor. It says, you know, you wouldn't go to a warfare on your own charges, right? You wouldn't keep the flock without drinking the milk of the flock, he says. And then he sums it up where he says that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel, right? So pastors should be paid for their what they do for the church. I think it's absolutely insane and ridiculous among some churches out there that they expect their pastors to work a full-time job and to not be supported. That's nuts. That makes no sense. I mean, it's completely contrary to Scripture. They which preach the gospel should live with the gospel. But it's just contrary to common sense. How much time do you think the man has in his life? You think he's going to be able to work full-time and do full-time ministry and do all the studying and sermon preparation and counseling and helping people or whatever? Of course not. He's either going to totally burn himself out and then quit the ministry, which is what a lot of them do, or he's going to do a lousy job at his full-time secular occupation and his ministry occupation because a guy's only got so much time in the day. Churches that do that are stupid. They're shooting themselves in the foot. Now, of course, the pastor's not supposed to be in the ministry for the purpose of making money, but he should be paid. And sadly, I think most pastors are underpaid from just experience, not my own necessarily, but from what I've seen out there. And I was reading Dave Ramsey's book, and he can say things that I won't, because if I said it, it would look like it's self-serving or whatever. Go read his book, see what he has to say about it. He does not have a nice thing to say about churches that do not support their pastors liberally. He said flat out, these guys ought to be paid, and they ought to be paid well, because you expect them to be highly educated professionals, great public speakers, counselors, managers. I mean, you expect them to basically be supermen and then pay them pitifully. He's like, what the heck's wrong with you? I mean, these guys ought to be paid very well. That's his words, not mine. And he gave a statistic that, like, I forget, and this is 15 or so years ago, but just like massive number of pastors leaving the ministry every year, continually. And there are big time shortages of pastors, pretty much like across the board in almost every type of church. Massive shortages. I'm sure maybe part of the reason is because they're overworked and underpaid. That could be part of it. Another part of it is just a great apostasy and a falling away. But anyway, his thought was, these guys are just flat out burnt out. You expect way too much work out of them, and you don't pay them well. And it makes sense. All right, now let me talk about something else. Does money buy happiness? This is just some interesting stuff here. I mentioned this earlier a bit. Last Sunday. Does money buy happiness? Now, the conventional wisdom is, and we've all heard it said a million times over, money does not buy happiness, right? Everybody's said that, right? Money does not buy happiness. And that's partly true and partly untrue. Because a certain amount of money will certainly buy you a certain amount of happiness. $3 will buy a good cup of coffee, and that will bring some people happiness. I know it does me. Give me $3 or $4 or whatever to buy a good quality cup of coffee, and that'll make me happy. That'll give me a good hour or so of happiness. Absolutely. $15 will buy a delicious lunch at one's favorite restaurant, which will bring happiness. I mean, depending on what your favorite restaurant is. But $15 will buy me lunch at my favorite restaurant, and it will bring me a lot of happiness for an hour or so. $200 a month in Florida in August will buy air conditioning, which will bring a lot of happiness. A lot of happiness. But it doesn't ultimately bring happiness. Money is not going to meet your innermost needs for love and community and friendship and all of those things and relationship with God and so on. Studies and surveys have shown that an increase of income correlates to an increase of happiness, but only to the point at which one's needs are met and one can live comfortably. I have a quote here from an article by Tim Jewell. It's called, Can You Buy Happiness? This is from 2019. He says, a 2010 study based on a Gallup poll of more than 450,000 respondents suggest that making an income up to $75,000 a year may make you feel more satisfied with your life. Now, this is 2010, and I think I think the number is about 90,000 now with inflation. So substitute 75 with 90 for today's dollars. So making up to $90,000 a year will make you feel more satisfied with your life. This survey only looked at people in the United States. Another Gallup poll from 2017, Trusted Source, whatever that is, surveyed people from around the world and resulted in similar findings. According to survey results, emotional well-being may be reached when a person earns between $60,000 and $75,000, which, you know, would be probably be between 75 and 90 or something today. Satiation may occur when a person earns around $95,000, so, you know, maybe a hundred and a quarter or something like that today. The article goes on to say, a 2010 study by noted economist and psychologist Daniel Kahneman found that where wealth is concerned, a person's satisfaction with their life no longer increases after about $75,000 a year. At this point, most people are better able to handle major life stressors like poor health, relationships, or loneliness than if they're making less or are below the poverty line. Beyond that, daily habits and lifestyle are the main drivers of happiness. So, and I think that this is probably true, that your level of happiness will correlate with a level of income up to a certain point. And, you know, nowadays, $90,000. And as I said a few weeks ago, you could be happy on a lot less than $90,000. But if you get to that point, especially if you have a family, now, if you had a bunch of kids or something, you'd probably need more. But if you had a normal-sized family today with $90,000, you could live comfortably. And beyond that point, all you're going to do is just, all most people are going to do is just acquire a bunch more crap that they don't need and spend a bunch more money on junk that they don't need. So the quality of their life is not going to improve any. Wouldn't matter how much money they had. Solomon's experience confirms the findings of this study. You remember first Ecclesiastes 2, the first part of the chapter there, 1 through 11, and he details there, and I'm not going to read it in the interest of time, but he details there about how he had gotten great wealth, and he had men servants and women servants and men singers and women singers, and he had gardens, and he had, you know, builded buildings and all kinds of things. I mean, he had everything that heart could wish, everything that you could imagine he had. And he ends it all with saying it's all vanity and vexation of spirit. Let me just get the punchline there in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Solomon confirms these findings. Then I looked, verse 11, then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. Nope. If you're not happy with $90,000 a year, you're not going to be happy with $190,000 or $290,000 or $490,000, whatever. It's not going to make any bit of difference. And for that matter, if you're not happy with $40,000 a year, you're probably not going to be happy with $90,000 either. If your basic needs are met and you're not happy, chances are you're not going to be any happier with more money. Now, for most people, and I'll have more to say about this, but for most people, the more they make, the more they spend. So most people, the more money they make, it doesn't increase their happiness at all because they don't actually have any more breathing room in their budget regardless. I mean, you give them an extra $1,000, they just spend an extra $1,000. They go out and buy another car, they go out and buy a toy, they buy this, they buy that, whatever. They go out to eat more, and before you know it, that $1,000 is gone, and then they need another $1,000, right, as I said last week. So the more they make, the more they spend. They're available income really doesn't change. The more they spend, the more stuff they have to manage and maintain. And the more stuff they have to manage and maintain, the more stress they have in their lives. Remember Ecclesiastes 5, 11, and 12, which we just read earlier, that the abundance of the rich suffereth them not to sleep. All he can do is behold it with his eyes. And the more possessions and stress they have, the less time they have to spend building quality relationships, which brings true happiness. And that's really where true happiness comes from. Quality relationships with friends and family. Money is not going to buy that. It won't buy true happiness. H. Jackson Brown Jr. in Life's Little Instruction Book said, "Understand that happiness is not based on possessions, power, or prestige, but on relationships with people you love and respect." And my grandfather, Leon Wagner, said, "Money is the short end of life, but everybody needs a little." And he was a poor farmer for most of his life. But he ended up dying with a pretty nice little fortune, honestly. It's amazing what somebody can do who's frugal and just slowly saves money. And that poor little farmer and his wife ended up having quite a little bit of money at the end of their lives. But money was not his goal. All right, I think, let me see here. I just have a few more points to make, and we'll be done. The next section is going to be longer, and I don't want to try to roll it into that. Let's just briefly talk about acquiring money and wealth. And I'll talk more about this next Sunday. If you are to have wealth legitimately, it must be worked for. Okay? There are other ways to get it, but that's not the way to go. Wealth that is gotten by hard work will last, but wealth gotten by vanity, such as luck or winning the lottery or something, will not last. Proverbs 13:11. This is why most lottery winners, and I'll talk about this later in the study, most lottery winners, or a lot of them, end up broke shortly after winning the lottery. And there's a good reason for that, because most people that buy lottery tickets are poor people. I don't know if you know that or not, but most people that buy lottery tickets are poor people. Lottery tickets, the lottery system, is a tax on the poor. That's all it is. State runs it, it's a tax on the poor. If you don't believe me, just go to especially a lower end gas station. Go to the Walmart gas station. Go to a cheap gas station. That's where I used to go. I kid you not, every time I walked in that place, there's somebody in line in front of me, and you know what he's buying? Cigarettes and lottery tickets. Every single time. Does the guy have any money? Of course he doesn't have any money. That's why he's buying cigarettes and lottery tickets. But that's the poor's idea of how they're going to get wealthy, is buying lottery tickets. In case you didn't know, that's the dumbest idea ever, to get wealthy. That will make you poor. You will not get wealthy buying lottery tickets. So you can imagine, when somebody like that wins the lottery, how long is that windfall going to last? No time at all. Proverbs 13:11 says, wealth gotten by vanity, which is nothingness, futility. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. If you work and you slowly acquire money and you get it by laboring, you're going to increase. If you're frugal, you get it by the lottery or inheritance, it's not going to last most of the time. Someone that comes into great wealth through an inheritance, like I just said, will likely lose it just as quickly. Proverbs 10:21. How many people do you know that received an inheritance and saved the whole thing? Probably not very many. How many do you know that received an inheritance and saved most of it? Probably not very many. They get it and they blow it, which is what most people do. It's very sad. Their parents worked and saved their whole lives, and the kids blow it in a matter of probably months. Some of them blow it before they even get it. They blow it in anticipation of getting it. I've seen it happen. Proverbs 20:21. An inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. You know, better is the end of a thing than the beginning, except when it comes to getting an inheritance. Self-made millionaires are frugal and know how to manage money. Heirs of inheritances usually don't, unless they're taught well. Now, there are, statistically, as I've been reading in this book, some of the heirs of self-made millionaires are good with money, and they receive the money, and it's generational wealth. But it's only the ones who have been taught well. The parents taught them. The parents were frugal themselves and instilled that in their children. They didn't give their children stuff as they were growing up. They made them work. They made them earn their way. They didn't spoil them and give them a bunch of junk they don't need. Right? Those kids, they receive an inheritance, and it's generational wealth, and it gets passed down. But the other ones, it's gone. The Bible teaches in Proverbs 1:32 that the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. So if you give stupid people money, it actually doesn't even help them. It makes them worse. Proverbs 1:32, for the turning away of the simple, that is stupid, The turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. That's a dangerous thing to give a fool money. Look at the prodigal son. He wanted the part of the inheritance that was set to be his. And his father gave it to him. What did he do with it? Gone. Partied. Ran around with hookers. Gone. Gone in no time. See, his dad gave him an inheritance, but he didn't give him wisdom with the inheritance. You know, the Bible says that wisdom with an inheritance is good. That's a rough paraphrase. His dad apparently never imparted to him wisdom. He just gave him money. That's a really bad idea. Really, really bad idea. So if you want to obtain wealth, you got to work for it. See, talk is cheap. People that only talk about making money usually don't have much. Proverbs 14 and verse 23. You probably met people like that. They like to talk about making money. They like to talk about starting their business. They like to talk about all kinds of stuff, but that's all it is talk. They never move beyond the lips flapping, whatever. Proverbs 14 and verse 23. In all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury, which is poverty. See, in all labor, there's profit. So there's no job that's beneath you. But if you're just going to talk about making money, you're not going to have any. Karl Marx, his wife, you know who Karl Marx is. He was one of the founders of communism, basically. He wrote the Communist Manifesto. And he wrote a great big book called Das Kapital, which is German probably for money or something, capital, something or other. Anyway, wrote a great big book on economics and money from a Marxist insane perspective. Anyway, his wife allegedly exhorted him to quit writing so much about capital and start working to earn some. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I heard anyway. All right, so next time I will pick it up and we'll look at the different ways to acquire wealth. And we're going to look at being an employee, an employer, and some of that kind of stuff. So that should be interesting to look at from a biblical perspective. So thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.